Today, we continue the discussion of the quantization of the non-abelian gauge series by discussing in detail how you really fix the gauge and get a consistent quantization scheme. Namely, so we are going to discuss the issue of the Fadeyev of quantization scheme, namely those famous ghost field that appear in the quantization. So remember what we did. We have a gauge series. Let's say I consider the SU2 Young Mills. I'm not going to discuss the coupling to matter field because that's easy to deal once you have understood what you do for SU2. So we have a gauge field configuration A, which means some A mu A of X is A goes from 1 to 3. Which are the gauge potentials. And we want to compute something which is the path integral, integral over A of exponential I S Young Mills of A, where both A, S Young Mills, and the measure are gauge invariant. So there is a gauge invariance, so that if we change A into A of G, which is, I remind to you, this is G A plus or minus, I never remember, I think there is a minus I, no plus, I D of G minus 1. The A and mu indices being understood, then both the measure and the Young-Mills action are supposed, well, this is, the classical action is invariant, and I argued but didn't show that the measure is also gauge invariant. So this is gauge invariance. Okay. And so, remember, if we have this big, I draw this picture yesterday, I consider a big space, which is the space of all gauge configuration, all possible A's. Okay? And the gauge group acts as orbits of the gauge group, where A is a set of gauge field configuration, and G is just a set of G. Now again, G means a set of G of X, G. So there is one gauge transformation performed independently at each space, each point of space. So this is local gauge invariance. Okay, and in order to define a consistent perturbation theory, we want to integrate over this whole space in a gauge invariant way, but by choosing a representative on each gauge orbit by imposing a gauge condition. And the gauge condition, gauge fixing condition, is just I choose some function or sets of gauge fixings that I'm denoting f of A. Well, in fact, this means that at each point of space-time, Minkowski space, and for each component the gauge field, I choose a condition which reads something like that. Fa of A at point X, where this is a functional, a local functional, and I enforce that f of a is equal to 0, which defines this big game. So for each point of space and a, f a of x is equal to 0. And this defines the gauge fixed. Okay? And examples of gauge fixing condition are, and the one that I'm going to discuss is a Landau or Lorentz Landau gauge, where you take that f a of a at point x is just d mu of a mu a of x is equal to 0. I'm going to discuss later a modification of Landau gauge, which is called the Feynman gauge, which is almost the same, simply instead of setting this to 0, you had some arbitrary function a of x equals 0. Okay? And okay, I might mention a third example of gauge which is useful, but I don't think I will have time to take, which is called the background gauge, where it's a variant of this, where instead of this, instead of chasing some function, you choose some specified fixed background gauge field. So you choose a background gauge field A bar mu of A, which is of X, which is a fixed gauge potential, which is and you take, as for FA of A of X, instead of taking the ordinary derivative, you take the covariant derivative where D bar mu is a covariant derivative in A bar, A mu, namely D bar mu is the ordinary derivative minus I times the commutator of A bar mu with what you are going to take the derivative. Okay? And it's useful. You can see that it's a variant of this where you take as epsilon of A something that depends on A. It's a commutator of A with R bar mu. So it's still linear, but a little more complicated. Okay. And so now, how do we proceed according to Feynman, DeWitt, Kadayev, and Popov? So we have seen first that if you consider some A.
Here,
yes?
We only consider one set of gauge fixing conditions.
Pardon?
Actually three F, right? But
you have three Fs and an infinite set of X.
Yeah,
so for.
What, but what if the gauge condition cannot fully fix the gauge? I mean, what if it has a residual gauge freedom?
Oh, because, well, then it means that you want to partially fix the gauge, but still.
Yeah, then do we need to introduce another gauge condition?
No, that's enough. At least locally, that's enough. Because, for instance, if you have only one gauge field, so that's a U1, that's Maxwell's theory. You know that Lorentz gauge, you know, d mu, a mu is enough. So simply here, since we have three gauge fields, belongs to a multiplet of SU2, then you need to fix each of these components. So that's enough. If you count well, you see that you are fixing as many gauge conditions as you have generators for the gauge transformation. You have three generators for the gauge transformation, so you need three gauge conditions to fix these degrees of freedom, this arbitrariness in the definition of the gauge potential. Okay. So let's go back to just perhaps this. Let me go back to this. So the principle is that let us consider a gauge orbit. This is a gauge orbit. In this. So, and let me assume that this is a gauge configuration, and this is my gauge slice. Gauge fixing slice. And let me assume that for each gauge orbit, there is a unique A naught such that F of A naught is equal to zero. And so this means that if this is the correct picture, and locally it will be the correct picture, it means that for any A gauge configuration, some point here, there is a hopefully unique gauge transformation and let me call it G naught, which send A to A naught. A of G naught is equal to A naught, namely such that F of E naught, which is A of G naught, is equal to zero. Okay, so you can, if you start from a gauge configuration that doesn't satisfy the gauge fixing condition, by performing a gauge transformation, you can always satisfy the gauge transformation. That's what the gauge fixing condition has been devised for. Okay. Of course, these G naughts, depends on A and on F, the choice of gauge configuration. If you choose another A, it will be something else. And if you choose another F, it will be something else. So let me denote, it's going to be a slightly heavy. So let us denote it G naught equal GF of A. It's a very, very compact notation, but it means that it depends on the gauge configuration and it depends on the choice of gauge fixing. Okay? And now, here is a beautiful trick. We start from my I'm going to write something which seems trivial. I'm going to write an integral over the gauge group with a delta function corresponding to this GF of A. So I'm going to write that 1 is equal to integral over the gauge group D of G, so this is the R measure on the gauge group, and a delta function on the gauge group of G and of GF of A. Okay, so it's a delta function, Dirac delta function. And this is an integral over the gauge group. So I want to write one as the integral over all the gauge group of the gauge with the delta function of the gauge transformation that fixes A. And we have seen that in general. So this is trivial. But now, since GF of A is determined by the condition that F of A of GF of A is equal to 0, I can rewrite this as an integral over the gauge group with the R measure, then a delta function of F of AG. So this is the condition that fixes GF of A. Okay? But of course, we have seen that when we do that, we have to take into account the Jacobian of the transformation. So I have to write the absolute value of the determinant of a Jacobian function that I'm going to write the derivative of A taken at AG. Okay? And I'm going to describe, explain what this means. So what is this F prime? So remember, what does this mean? This means that, in fact, I have an infinite sets of gauge condition. And taking the derivative means that I take the derivative of this function when I make a variation of F with respect to a variation of A. Okay. So this means that in fact this object that I'm going to call F prime of AG is in fact a big matrix, a very big matrix. So in fact, it will be the kernel of an operator. And what is this operator? Okay. So I am making a variation with respect to G of the function F prime of A of G. So what is? So it's a kernel of an operator. It's a derivative of this function with respect to variation of G. So what is a variation of G? What is a of G? So we have seen that going to, from G to G prime equal G plus delta G can always be written as G times 1 plus I alpha, where alpha is an infinitesimal generator in the Lie algebra. Okay. So it means that alpha means, so it's a gauge transformation, so it's local. And alpha of x means alpha b of x tb summed over the indices. So these are the generators. This is the basis of the Lie algebra. Remember, tb are one half of the sigma of the poly matrices, B equal 1, 2, 3. These are the poly matrices. So this is a anti-symmetric matrix, and this is a SU2 matrix. So this is a variation of G. So a variation of G is measured by a variation of alpha. It's a local rotation. Okay? And so what I'm so F prime of AG is in fact means that I'm considering a big matrix. So it's a 3x3 matrix. Because it's measure the variation of the gauge condition FA when I make a variation in the direction B of the gauge group. So this is a 3x3 matrix. But in addition, since general gauge conditions are non-local, they involve derivatives, this will not be, this will be something non-local. So this will depend on the gauge condition that I take at point X and of the variation at point Y. Okay? And this is, this object is just what is the variation of the gauge condition FA of A of G times 1 plus I delta alpha. Of alpha, let us say. So this will be something like this. This will be f of 1 plus I delta alpha taken at a point x minus fa of ag at point x, okay, divided by delta alpha B at point Y. So I make a variation, a gauge transformation. Gauge transformation at point Y, and I see the effect of this on the gauge fixing. Fixing term at point X. And I take the AB element. So this is a big, so this is the kernel of some operator on space-time. And it's a 3x3 matrix because it's a matrix that send the tangent space, the Lie algebra, onto the Lie algebra. OK, so this is.
Why do we use delta alpha, though? I thought alpha already was in the decimal.
No, no, okay, so let's take that, let's write this like this. Delta alpha is an infinitesimal generator. Yes. Alpha, yes.
And in the numerator of this expression, where it says 1 plus I delta alpha, the delta alpha only has one component now, written in the base of TAs?
Yeah, so I make a delta. I see what's happening when delta alpha is equal to delta alpha beta. So if you prefer, I can write this in a more natural way as dFA of A of G1 plus I alpha at point X. I take the derivative with alpha B at point X, and I set alpha to zero, so that I'm at point G. Okay, so take this. This is a differential expression with a small derivative, and this is a formal expression. So this is what I'm calling F prime A at point A, for gauge configuration AG, matrix element AB of a kernel at the point X and Y. So it is this big object that I want to, and I want to compute the absolute value of the determinant of this, the operator that has this kernel. Okay? And again, well, determinant means that I take the determinant of this 3x3 matrix, and I take the determinant of this kernel operator. Okay, so it's a bit, you see, it's a bit lengthy, but this is what it corresponds to, and this is just a very, well, but once you have understood that, this is a very, you know, natural notation for this. Okay? Yes?
F of A was originally just an equation for the gauge fixing. But now all of a sudden F prime becomes an operator?
It's an operator because, in fact, it's an operator in the sense that it's a big matrix, both in acting on the Lie algebra, and it's a big matrix. It's an operator acting on function from space onto the Lie algebra. You see, you take value that at a given point of space assign an element of the Lie algebra. And this object is a linear operator in this space, but it's a non-local operator. See? See? You take if you take functions that are functions in the Lie algebra, so these are the components. Okay? And this operator, F prime of AG, is an operator that sends a function psi into a function psi prime equal F prime of AG times psi. So it's a linear operator, which means that psi prime of x is integral dy, and this big object, f prime of ag, so the component a, well, prime is a big notation, so let this psi tilde a, the component of this is this element of xy times psi b of y. So it's a convolution in space, and it acts as an ordinary matrix in the Lie algebra. So that's just what it means. So, and you see that with this definition, f prime is a linear operator acting on the space of linear functions, of functions from space in the Lie algebra. But as we are going to see later, it's a linear operator, but it has a kernel, and in fact, it turns out that it is a differential operator because the gauge fixing condition involves derivative of the field. Okay, but before going seeing that, let us just continue. Okay, so I wrote in a somewhat involved way one, and so now let me start from this big functional integral. The original functional integral, which was dA exponential minus, well, I S Young Mills of A. And let me add here G. So let me add here integral D of G delta F of AG times this determinant. Well, this determinant is okay. Well, this notation is not, let me just to be clear. absolute value times integral dA exponential of IS Young Mills of A. Okay. So I've done nothing except that we can when doing this, of course, I've inserted one into, I should have inserted it here, and here I have inverted, already integral d of a times integral d of g into an integral over d of g and an integral over d of a. And in fact, I can write this as integral d of g integral over d of a, and here I write this delta function of f of ag, absolute value of the determinant of my big differential operator, this is the absolute value, times exponential of I s Young Mills of a. Okay. This is a bit formal. So this is an integration over all the gauge potential configuration. And this is an integration over all the gauge transformation, the big gauge group. Okay. But now we know that this is invariant under gauge transformation, and this is invariant under gauge transformation. And now the integral over the gauge group here has been put outside. So in this integral, we can make a change of variables, can make change or variables, and instead, for a fixed g, instead of integrating over a, I can integrate over ag. Inside this integral, you see, because ag is just a dummy variable here. So, in this big integral. Because this integral, I can replace here a by ag, and a by ag. Okay? And so, this becomes just a big integral over d of g times something that is completely independent of g, which is the integral over A, the measure of the gauge potential configuration, the delta function that ensures the gauge fixing condition, this determinant, which is now determinant of f prime, but evaluated at the gauge configuration A, times exponential of the Young-Mills action, evaluated of A. Okay. And this factor out, this is just the volume of the gauge group. So it's an infinite factor, but it's just an infinite factor because the gauge group is a direct product of SU2 at each point of space. So it's an extensive factor. So it's this. This is the volume of SU2 to the power the number of points of space. Okay. But it's a constant. It's completely independent of A. So it's just a normalization of the measure that comes out. Okay. So it's independent of A. Independent of, and it's in particular, it's independent of the action. You have no dynamics. Okay. And so, this is just a normalization factor, and we can replace the path integral by this path integral where there is a gauge fixing condition. Condition, because this delta function enforces that f of a is equal to zero, but with this determinant.
Sorry, could you please repeat what you did in the last step?
Pardon?
Can you please repeat what happened in the last step?
What happened?
What you did in the last step?
In the last step, I just use the fact that because of gauge invariance, d of a is equal to d of ag, and s Young-Mills of a is equal to s Young-Mills of ag, whatever g is. So I can replace here a by ag and a by ag in the measure and Young-Mills. And once I've done that, I can redefine, if you prefer, ag to be equal a prime and integrate over a prime, which is what I'm doing this. You see? Because I've inverted the integral. So I have this integral over g, and for each value of g, I have this integral that I can rewrite as this integral. And now g doesn't appear anywhere in this integral. So I can factor out this from this. Okay, so we get this formula. We get that the total functional integral, if you want, is the volume of the gauge group that is just a factor times this gauge fixed.
Yeah, at this point, we have to be know something about the group, though, right? I mean, we have to know that it's simply connected and that it's compact, because otherwise this makes no sense, right? Because if the group has multiple connectivity components...
Yes. Yes. But here, I'm dealing with SU2.
Yeah.
So, yes. Otherwise, it's a bit more compact. But I think, gauge theories on uncompact group are something quite subtle. So, if you want, this factor is a finite number to the power infinite, but it's still finite because the volume of SU2 is infinite. And if you go to the lattice discretization of Wilson, then this becomes the volume of the space time. The number of points in space time is finite if you deal with a finite lattice. Therefore, everything makes sense. Okay. I think there is a way, because people are considering symmetry groups that are non-compact in some cases. But. Okay, so once we have done that, we just have now to compute this. And let's see what this corresponds to. So now, so this is a formal functional integral manipulation. And now we have to understand what these terms come from. So what is this? This Fadeyev-Popov determinant. So this is precisely the Fadeyev-Popov determinant. Fadeyev-Popov Okay. So how do we compute this determinant? So first, let us see what is this object. So now this is, so what is this f prime of A? as I wrote it here, it's just, but now I have G equals identity. So this is just the matrix element of this object are just AB of XY. This is just the derivative, the functional derivative of FA of A when I apply the gauge transformation 1 plus I alpha on the gauge configuration A. When I take a derivation with respect to alpha B of Y, and that's the gauge condition at point X, and I set alpha equal 0 at the end. So this is the definition. Okay, so let's see what is this object when F is given by the Feynman gauge. Well, the Feynman gauge, in fact, turns out to be just a generalization of the Landau gauge. So what is A of 1 plus I alpha A? And remember, I'm considering the gauge transform. We know that this is A mu A of X. Plus, what is the variation? D mu alpha A of X. Therefore, this is, okay, which means that, so this is A mu A of X plus D mu of alpha A of X plus epsilon A B C A mu B of X alpha C of X. Okay, for SU2. Okay. So the gauge condition F of A on 1 plus I alpha A mu of X. I'm sorry. A mu is my condition with my notation at point 6. And I'm considering the condition alpha. This is the ordinary derivative of this plus epsilon. So this is d mu mu A of X plus d mu, I'm sorry, plus the ordinary derivative times the covariant derivative of alpha A of X. Plus, if you want, by epsilon A of X, and so you see that this term contains alpha and alpha, which means when I take the derivative with respect to the component B of alpha, this is the first, I have the derivative, the functional derivative with alpha B of Y of d mu alpha A of X. which gives delta AB times the d over dx mu applied to the Dirac delta function delta of x minus y. And here I get a plus. I take a derivative with respect to alpha b. So I get an epsilon a cb a mu c of x. Okay. So,
what about the epsilon?
Pardon?
The epsilon a of x, can we assume that this doesn't depend?
Pardon?
The epsilon a of x, this function that we can add, that doesn't contribute at all? It's
epsilon a,
it's a Derrick's
function.
No, but this doesn't vary when you change alpha. This is a different function. So this, if I compute the derivative of this, then I just get this. And I think I have.
Is that the derivative?
Oh, I'm sorry, but then I have the d mu. Oh, yes, no, I am a bit, I went a bit too slow. So first I write. Yeah, so let me compute these terms. So this term is d mu of alpha a of x plus d mu epsilon a b c a mu b of x alpha c of x. Okay. This term. The terms that depend on alpha. Which means that, and here I've been a bit, I forgot the dA, in fact. So in fact, the variation with respect to this means that here you get a delta AB times the ordinary Laplacian operator. So you get this to be delta AB times the ordinary Laplacian, d mu a mu. And then you get an epsilon a cb, because here, areas in my notes, there are some d mu. So you see this operator, d mu, may act either on A or on alpha. So first you get a d mu, you get an epsilon ABC, and then you get an epsilon, a d mu A mu C and then you get another term which is epsilon A B C A mu, well let me write this as A C B epsilon a mu c times the operator d mu acting on alpha b. So this is an operator that acts on the left. This object, in fact, f prime of A is a differential operator. And this differential operator contains the ordinary Laplacian times the identity matrix. Yes?
What parts of it refer to x or y?
OK, so this, by differential operator, I mean that when I apply this operator f prime a on some function psi a of x, this is the ordinary Laplacian applies with respect to x applies to psi a of x plus epsilon a c b d mu a mu c of x times psi psi b of x. Okay? Plus epsilon a b c a mu c of x times d mu of psi b of x. Okay, and this is just d mu apply here and d mu apply here. So this is.
So nothing depends on y?
No, it depends. It depends on y if you write this as delta of x minus y. This as this object delta of x minus y, and this as d mu delta of x minus y, and you replace x by y here, here, and here. So it's the same rule that you can write the differential operator delta of x as having a kernel, which is delta of x applies to the Dirac distribution delta of x minus y. So it's exactly the same thing that we did in the first week, exactly the same rule. So in fact, this object is a kernel, but it's a kernel of a simple differential operator. So it's better to write it as a differential operator than and some non-local kernel. But in this case, everything involves the function and their derivative. OK. So f prime of a is in fact a differential operator. And we have seen that the determinant, functional determinant of differential operator are in fact non-trivial objects that appears in quantum field theory. We have seen that on the example of the free field. So this gives a non-trivial contribution because it's a differential operator. And it depends on A. On the gauge configuration. So it will give an additional. It modifies the action. So you see that in non-abelian gauge theories, it's not enough to just choose some gauge fixing condition. But this fixing of a gauge induced new contribution in the action that depends on the gauge fixing. And this is needed in order to compensate the naive contribution of the gauge fixing, so that this is indeed gauge invariant. So if you don't take into account this term, you are going to have a result that depends on the gauge fixing condition. And you don't want that, because it means that the theory, the procedure of quantization you are using is not consistent. And you are running into a lot of trouble with, for instance, unitarity. So taking this gauge fixing condition is required. This contribution is required if you want to have a consistent quantum theory. OK.
Can you please repeat why?
Pardon? What?
Why that the functional is independent of the gauge fixing?
It's independent of the gauge fixing condition because I started from a functional integral where there is no gauge fixing. Okay, and I rewrote it as a functional integral that involves a gauge fixing condition times the volume of the gauge orbits. But the volume of the gauge orbits is independent of the gauge fixing. It's just the volume of a group. So since this is independent of the gauge fixing condition, this is independent of the gauge fixing condition, this has to be independent of the gauge fixing condition. Okay? Yes?
But the claim was that you can factor out the volume of the gauge group, which is
yes.
What we would naively expect, but then there's also a contribution of this determinant acting on the action, right? Because
yeah. But this determinant compensates the change in the measure induced by a delta function of f of some function instead of having a delta function of g, which would be gauge invariant. So it's exactly the same mathematical phenomenon that occurs with the one-dimensional integral that I explained yesterday at the end of the course. So it's nothing to be surprised. I'm just rewriting in a very complicated fashion the fact that delta of f of x is delta of x is delta of f of x times f prime of x.
The determinant is a number.
Yes. Yes, it's a number. So now I'm going to show you how you compute this determinant. Okay. So how to compute this determinant? Okay, so first remark, we have the absolute value of a determinant. And so I'm going to write the absolute value of this determinant of f prime as the determinant of f prime, which is of course valid only if the determinant is positive. Okay? But so that's a strong assumption. But this strong assumption is related to the fact that you are working in the vicinity of the classical vacuum. Okay? And basically, these determinants measure, in some sense, the slope of the gauge slice with respect to the orbit. So for instance, if here the determinant is positive, here it will be negative, here it will be positive. It's a very, very crude idea. So in fact, the problem of the sign is related to this problem of Gribov ambiguities. The sign problem is related to the Gribov problem. And I argued that the Gribov problem was irrelevant to define perturbation theory. Yes?
In which step we are only working near the classical action? Like, isn't that we are integrating over all possible?
Yeah, but here also I made the assumption that there was only one minimum. So in any case, at that stage, I am assuming that I can forget about the Gribov problem. Because this problem is irrelevant for perturbation around A equals zero, which is the classical vacuum. And you see, in the classical vacuum, if A equals zero, basically, this operator is just a scalar Laplacian. And up to a sign, we have seen that in that case, you know, if A equals 0, F prime is basically up to a constant minus the scalar Laplacian. In fact, here there is a plus sign, but you can just sign, which is positive. Minus the Laplacian is a positive operator because its eigenvalues are k squared, okay, which is positive. So, okay, so if we do that, I realize in my notes this determinant is written G, but it's not very important. Let's keep the determinant F prime. So now, here is a beautiful trick introduced by Fadeyev and Popov. The idea is to introduce additional anti-commuting fields. To write the determinant, so to write this determinant, determinant of F prime as a path integral over C bar, two fields C bar and C, exponential of, and I'm going to write this as I, that's not very important, C bar F prime C. We have seen that integrating over Grassmann complex numbers gives determinant. Yes?
Why is it that F prime at A equals 0 is minus Laplacian?
Well, I said it's proportional because written here it's plus delta the way I wrote it, but if I multiply it by minus 1, in fact, if you want written like this, F prime is negative, but I can write that determinant of F prime is determinant of minus F prime is the determinant is negative. In any case, this is true. So I'm going to take, I just realized that there was a sign number in my notes. So I'm going to, you agree with this. So if you prefer.
Wouldn't that depend on whether F is even or odd dimension?
Yes, but it's infinite. So in any case, if you have a sign here, you can put it in the constant.
Why do you talk about I?
Pardon?
When we do the Grassmann
integral. If you prefer, take as a gauge condition minus d mu a mu equals 0. Change f in minus f. And then the determinant is positive. So take F to be minus d mu a mu. Okay? And repeat the operation, and then F is positive. So this sign is not important. So the important thing is that you have a determinant for A equals 0, and when you start to have a non-zero but small gauge field, the sign doesn't change. Okay. So the trick is due to Fadeyev and Popov. It's to represent this determinant as a path integral over exponential involving gauge field, Grassmannian, so anti-commuting field. So in this case, what are those fields? Remember, F prime is a differential operator acting on the Lie algebra. So it carries indices. So it's a matrix AB, and it's a differential operator in A. So you need to have that C is in fact a collection of three anti-commuting gauge field. You see? X is a position in Minkowski space, and A is 1, 2, 3 for SU2. And C bar is going to be the conjugate field. So it's C bar A of X. Well, let us write this A, B, with X belonging to M and A equal 1, 2, 3. Okay? So these are anti-commuting variables. So these are Grassmann. Numbers, Grassmann generator of some big algebra. These are fields that depends on space time. They carry the quantum number of the Lie algebra. Belongs to the Lie algebra as the gauge potential, MUA, so they carry the same charge than the Lie algebra. But one important point is missing. They have no Dirac or Lorentz indices. They are scalar. No Lorentz or Dirac indices. So these fields are scalar in the sense that spin zero fields. But the fact that they are Grassmann variables means that obey the Fermi-Dirac statistics. So if you treat this system and try to construct an Hilbert space representation of this system, you discover that the creation and annihilation operator anti-commutes despite the fact that they are spin zero fields. So they violate the spin statistics theorem. Okay? Yes?
Like when we did a Grassmann integral, like isn't that determinant of some A is equal to integral of exponential minus FC?
Yes, but again, I can write determinant, I can write this integral of determinant of minus I. You can. This integral will give you determinant of I f prime, if I apply my rules, which is I to some constant times the determinant of f prime. So it's this I here is, I'm going to introduce it for convenience. But it's just a change in the normalization of the determinant. So again, it means that you change by some factor the normalization. But remember, in this A, in fact, there are lots of factor I, etc. So in any case, the normalization of the path integral is not very well defined. But it's not important when you compute correlation function of operator, because you have an undefined factor in the numerator and an undefined factor in the denominator, so they cancel out. So this term, as well as this term, as well as this problem of sign, is unimportant. For vacuum expectation value of operators, S matrix elements, etc. Just okay. So they violate the spin statistics theorem. And the spin statistics theorem, I don't know if you have seen that in detail in QFT1, but it's an important theorem that's a consequence of Lorentz invariance, locality, and causality. And unitarity, of course. So we want to construct a theory that satisfies causality and locality. So in fact, it turns out that these fields violate unitarity. So we need them to define a path integral and perturbation theory, but there is a risk that for physical amplitudes, there are violations of unitarities. And it turns out that gauge invariance implies that when you take physical states, products of physical states. Physical states means states with no ghost in it, no ghost field. Then this is still positive. So probabilities, amplitudes, or probabilities involving those ghost fields may be negative. But probabilities involving physical states with states, quantum particles created by applying the gauge potential operator are okay. Okay, so I'm not going to discuss that more, but don't be worried about this. Okay, so now what do we get? This means that this determinant can be, in this case, remember F prime is a differential operator. So this action IC bar F prime F will take the form of a Dirac-like action, but involving spin zero field. Yes?
How is this different from the Gupta-Bleuler condition we had in QED?
From the
Gupta-Bleuler condition we use in, conditions we use in QED to eliminate the unphysical degree of freedom of AVS.
That's an involved theory that involves, in fact, a property of the series that I'm going to define, which is called the BRST symmetry. If I have time, I will say a few words about it tomorrow. But at that stage, it's not.
Is this the analog of the Gupta-Bleuler condition in QED?
Of the Gupta-Bleuler. I'm sorry. Yes, except that in QED you don't need ghosts. But that's so. It's something additional.
Don't they correspond to ghosts?
Pardon?
You have to introduce something unphysical to remove the longitudinal
field. Yes. No, there is a mixture. The point is that I'm going to discuss that tomorrow. In non-Abelian gauge theories, you have the unphysical degrees of freedom, and you have degrees of freedom associated to the ghost field. And both of them are eliminated.
That's exactly what happens with the ghost.
Yes, but there is a mixture between unphysical degrees of freedom and the ghost degrees of freedom. So it's the situation is more complicated. But that's a generalization of Gupta-Bleuler. Yes. Okay, so let me go back to this intermediate step. So what we get is that in this case, you know, I can rewrite this exponential of I C bar F prime F as an action for the ghosts field, which involves the gauge field C and C bar, which is simply integral d4x, okay? Then I get C bar A of x. Then I introduced my differential operator F prime, which is with my choice of sign delta AB minus Laplacian operator times CB of x. Okay, that's the first term. And I put a minus sign in order for this to be positive. And then I get And since I change of sign, I'm going to change the epsilon AB into epsilon ACB into an epsilon ABC. And that I get an epsilon ABC d mu C bar A of X. Ah, I'm sorry. Yes. D mu C mu A bar of X. No, I can write it this way. A mu B of X C C of X. Okay, I played a little bit with the anti-symmetry of the factor and perform some partial integration so that the derivative d mu operator acts on C bar instead of acting on A mu B C C. Okay. So this is the action, if you want, action term for the ghosts. Okay? And once you have done that, what you get for the path integral has the following form. You get an integral over the gauge potential, an integral over the ghost field, a delta function that involves the gauge fixing condition, and then an exponential of I times the Young-Mills action for the gauge field plus the ghost action for C and C bar, but that contains a dependence in the ghost potential, because you see that through these terms, the ghosts are coupled to the gauge potential. So they interact with the gauge potential. Okay. And finally, let me give, so finally we have to treat that. We have to see how do we implement that in perturbation theory. And well, you can do that in different ways. It depends, of course, of the gauge. So let me use the Feynman gauge and use a little trick. Use the fact that instead of writing the gauge condition as delta of d mu a mu minus epsilon equals zero. This is a gauge condition that depends on epsilon. You see? If I'm using the Feynman gauge, I will have this. This is F epsilon. So F epsilon is this, if you want. This is F epsilon. If I worked correctly, this is independent on epsilon. It doesn't depend on choice. So if everything is okay, this is independent of epsilon. So instead of choosing one choice of gauge, I can average over a different one. So it's just a trick. It's a trick that means that instead of integrating over a slice here, instead of integrating over a slice corresponding to some f epsilon, I integrate over some, I make an average over f epsilon. Epsilon, but with just a Gaussian weight. So replace this by an average of the form integral over d epsilon exponential of minus I over 2 some parameter chi integral d4x epsilon a of x epsilon a of x. So I replace this delta of f epsilon of a by integral d epsilon exponential of this times delta of f epsilon of a. Pardon? It's just a choice, a normalization. So it's like a Gaussian, but a Gaussian with a... Yeah, but it means that instead of taking a Gaussian on the real axis, I consider a Gaussian on the... If you consider the Gaussian function a puissance minus x squared, you see? And you consider x in the complex plane. Well, this integral is convergent on the real axis, but in fact it decays at infinity. In this domain and in this domain. So you can rotate the contour of integration to integrate. So instead of considering a contour of integration like this, I can take a contour of integration like this, as long as I don't go. And this amounts to change x into x times e to the I pi over 4. So x squared is changed into x squared times I. So you can replace this exponential minus I x squared with no arm if you take into account carefully the boundary condition. So that's the trick. And as usual with Richard Feynman, the trick works. Yes?
Is the epsilon real or complex?
So epsilon is real because epsilon is real, is a real variable. It's because, remember, each epsilon is an epsilon A of X, and the component of A mu are real. But I mean that I compute this integral by considering epsilon real, and then, no. Here you may consider that epsilon is real, but you have a phase, or that you started from a Gaussian with real epsilon, and you make an analytic continuation. But that's pure math, so don't worry.
Can you repeat why you can do this?
Pardon? You'll see. That's because it gives perturbation rules that are simple. So it's a trick of Feynman. So it's just a trick to get simple perturbation theory. So that's one of the many, many gauge fixing conditions you can choose. And this one is particularly convenient. So it corresponds to a choice of gate fixing procedure. Okay? And the advantage of this procedure is that you see that once you do that, you may integrate over epsilon. So this means that from this, I insert this integral here over in addition. And since I have the constraint that epsilon is d mu a mu, I can rewrite this integral by replacing this by a d mu a mu squared. So the end result of this calculation, so I think we can forget about this. The end result of this, okay, let's keep the original action. End result of this particular choice of gauge fixing condition, but you can write some other one, is that you can forget about epsilon, because you can integrate over epsilon, because epsilon is fixed by the gauge fixing condition, because the gauge fixing condition is linear in epsilon. So you can integrate over epsilon. Epsilon. And what you get is final result. For the path integral, I have an integral over dA, an integral over dC and C bar, or C bar and C. And then I have an exponential times I times first the Young-Mills action of A, plus the contribution of the ghosts that I wrote already, A, C, C bar, and plus the contribution of this term, where I replace epsilon by d mu a mu. So I'm going to write this as a S psi of A, which is a term that comes from the gauge fixing of Feynman. Okay, where so S psi of A mu is just minus 1 over 2 psi, with this notation, integral d4x d mu a mu a of x d nu a nu a of x. Okay? S ghosts has been written here. And S Young-Mills is just the action that we wrote yesterday. So it's F mu nu A, F mu nu A, something like that. Okay, with f mu nu, d mu a nu minus d nu a mu, and plus or minus I, well, epsilon a b c u b and u c. Okay, the standard Young-Mills action. And tomorrow we are going to discuss the Feynman diagrammatic. Rules. And the structure of its perturbative expansion. But let me say just two things. First, now the linearized action contains this term squared plus this term. So the linearized action, S linear contains d mu a nu minus d nu a mu a squared plus 1 over xi d mu a mu squared. And now this has no zero mode. Thanks to the Feynman term. So the propagator of the gauge field exists as in QED. Okay? In fact, this Feynman gauge, you can use this trick in QED. It's not special to non-abelian gauge theories. So the propagator exists, the propagator of the gauge field, A mu, B nu. So we could have expected, we gauge fixed. Yes?
You have corresponding Ward identities?
You are going to have, of course, corresponding Ward identities, which means that for physical amplitudes on shell, they do not depend on xi, the gauge. So there is still a gauge fixing parameter, because this is arbitrary. And you are going to check that unphysical longitudinal degrees of freedom, longitudinal polarization, are not in the spectrum. Okay. But okay, so first there is this. But now second, so the propagator exists. We have seen that in perturbation theory, we have this interaction diagram, interaction of the gauge field vertices, But now we have the ghosts. Okay. And first, we have a ghost propagator. And remember, the ghost is a fermion. So it, sometimes it carries an arrow, like Dirac fermions. The ghosts carry the quantum numbers of the gauge field. So the ghost is charged. And it carries indices A, B. So the propagator of the ghost is basically delta AB 1 over P squared, because it's 1 over. So the propagator is a propagator, and there is a factor of minus I, and this is P squared minus I epsilon plus, if you look at it. So the ghosts are spin zero massless particles. Spin zero, massless, charged. So this is a propagator. And these terms means that since the ghosts are charged, they interact with the gauge field. So there is a vertex for the ghost, but I'm just going to write it. And let me write the ghost like a dashed line, because they are ghosts, so you are not really there. Okay, and so you have a vertex interaction where you have a ghost, an incoming ghost that comes out with a different charge, and it interacts with a gauge field with a Lorentz index mu, so some spin, and B. Okay, and since the gauge potential carries spin and the ghost carry no spin, the interaction has to involve the coupling with the spin with the momentum of the ghost, which is taken by the fact that there is a derivative here. And in fact, if you have a momentum, a spin that comes out with a momentum P, where it comes out with a momentum K, and the gauge field comes with a momentum P minus K, the interaction is of the form minus G epsilon ABC P mu. This is the vertex, interaction vertex. Vertex for having a C bar, a C, and an A interaction, gauge field interaction. Okay. And P is the momentum of the ghost. Yes?
So if you consider the case that the group is a billion, then this epsilon would vanish.
Yes.
But you would still have this ghost propagator term.
You mean?
So the interaction would be.
Ah, if you. If the group is abelian,
yeah, then
yes,
have,
no.
You still get the ghost propagator, but we didn't.
Yes, no, the point is that if you have a U1 abelian group, or, okay, in fact, there are ghosts, because the procedure I wrote can be repeated, but there are ghosts. Are there, but they are not coupled to the fermions.
So they just get absorbed in the constant?
Yeah, so in fact, the determinant of F prime is independent of A. Okay. So it means that, chop. It means that here, you can factor this out again. So it's a constant. And between the numerator and denominator, when you compute physical amplitudes, it's cancelled between the numerator and the numerator. So for abelian gauge theory, you can forget about that because it's independent of A. And that's precisely what you have been doing in QED. In QED, in fact, if you work out precisely a path integral formalism, there are ghosts, but they factor out. So you don't need to take them into account. There are just, in the path integral, there is some internal loop of ghosts, but that interact with nobody. And they don't interact with themselves either, because the ghost, you know, the ghost interacts only with the gauge field. So they are like neutral Dirac fermions, but with spin zero. So they cannot interact with the gauge potential because they are neutral. And they cannot interact with anything, anybody. And they, it turns out they cannot interact with matter either. Okay. So tomorrow we are going to discuss what this means for perturbation theory and how it makes sense and discuss a bit of the physics of gauge theories. Because all this was just a presentation of the formalism. Okay. Thank you.